This is Science Friday. I'm Sci-Fi producer Kathleen Davis, sitting in for Ira Flatto. Later in the hour, we'll talk to the author of a new book about history and climate change. But first, there's still a lot to be learned about the physics of our universe. And one of the most perplexing ideas is an observation made around a decade ago that the universe seems to be expanding faster than it should be. Now, 2 years of James Webb Space Telescope data back up that finding. Joining me now to talk about that and other topics from the week in science news is Casey Crownhart, climate and technology reporter at MIT Technology Review. Welcome back to Science Friday, Casey.
Thanks so much. Great to be here as always.
Great to have you. So explain this story to me. The universe is expanding too fast. What does that mean?
I know this one, as most space stories do, broke my brain a little bit. Basically, there are a couple of different ways that we can kind of measure or observe how fast the universe is expanding. One of them is by kind of looking back at the earliest light from just after the Big Bang, basically, and then doing calculations based on our understanding of like how the cosmos works. Another way is to take space telescope data, look at things that are very far away, stars, supernovas, and you can tell how far away they are and how fast they look to be moving. The problem is that those two ways of observing and measuring the expansion of the universe don't line up. And we've, like you said, we've known that since the Hubble Space Telescope, but now the James Webb Space Telescope really confirmed that. So now we can't really blame Hubble anymore and think that it's just some like instrument error. It looks to be a real problem.
So when we say too fast, we're talking about in the context of our own understanding of the universe, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's, and I mean that we're talking about like huge time scales, huge length scales. So it's significant. It's like about 8% faster, I think, than what it quote unquote should be, but it's significant.
So if we have confirmation that it wasn't just some telescope error, where does that leave physicists?
Yes, with a lot of questions to answer.
Right.
So there are definitely theories about where this might be coming from. Some of the leading ones are that dark matter or dark energy have something to do with this. These are things that we know exist in the universe, but are sort of invisible to us. We just kind of infer them based on how they affect regular matter and energy. So that is kind of a leading theory, but there's a lot of research to be done still, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to keep us on the head-scratching topics for just a little bit longer. Quantum computing. Google made an announcement this week about quantum computing. Tell me about this.
Yes, definitely in the same category of brain-breaking. So Google announced this week that it has a new quantum computing chip called Willow. And there are two really interesting things about this new chip. One is that it's capable of performing a computing challenge in less than 5 minutes, whereas today's the world's fastest supercomputers would take longer than the age of the universe to do the same kind of work. The other thing that's really interesting about this is that they were able to do error correction in a really interesting way. So one of the big problems that's keeping quantum computers from being useful is that the universe is a really noisy place, and things like the movement of electrons and like atomic effects can introduce errors into quantum computing. So the other interesting thing about this Google chip announcement is that they showed that as they built bigger computers or bigger quantum chips, they were able to correct errors.
So do we have any idea if this is something that Google's going to save for themselves and do quantum googly things, or are they maybe planning to sell this technology to other people?
That's a great question. They didn't say in their blog about this what exactly the plans are. But I mean, to be fair, we're still pretty far from this being useful. I mentioned that this is, you know, better at correcting errors than most quantum computers are, but it's still way, way, way off from doing things like solving algorithms or doing good simulations of chemistry, which are some things that quantum computers might eventually be used for. So we've still got a long way to go with the research here.
Okay, so let's move on to some more concrete electronics. You have a story for us from this week about improving the electronics of prosthetic devices, right?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting story in Wired this week. Phantom Neuro is an Austin-based startup that's trying to provide more lifelike control of prosthetic limbs. So basically what this company is doing is they want to build a thin, flexible muscle implant that they could put, you know, inside a limb, and that would allow amputees to have a wider, more natural range of movement. And also it would have a faster response time. So this would be a lot better than current prosthetics at basically acting more like, you know, a biological limb.
So there are other groups that are trying to do more neurological control directly in the brain, mm-hmm. right? How does this compare to those things?
Yeah, so this would be basically implanted in the muscle, so kind of close to where the amputation is. In theory, it could be less risky than doing a brain implant. You know, messing with the brain is like, what's going on there? And so this could be a little bit, you know, easier and less risky of a surgery and of a process. But also this company hasn't actually done implants yet. They are just announced data testing out kind of a wearable version of their device, which they did show worked pretty well. But the next stage, which they want to do next year, is start to do these implants to see how they really work.
What kind of prosthetics have they made or do they plan to make in terms of parts of the body?
Oh, yeah. So the test that they did was an arm, and they want to do this with kind of upper limb amputees. And so they were able to kind of have people doing, you know, opening and closing their hand, moving their wrist around, stuff like that. So arms is kind of the target for this first test.
Well, great. Well, let's hope that that technology advances to where people need it. Let's pivot away from electronics to some climate news. There's been kind of an Arctic climate report card that's come out with some, as you might imagine, some bad news about the tundra, right?
Yes, the news is not great in the Arctic. Based on this data, researchers are able to say kind of for the first time definitively that for the past 20 years, the tundra has been emitting more CO2, carbon dioxide, than it has removed. This is different from what's been happening for the last thousands of years. Usually the Arctic tundra locks away more carbon than it emits. You know, plants grow, they soak up carbon dioxide as they grow, they get buried in the soil, and that kind of gets locked away. And that's a great thing for, you know, climate change, because we want less of that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere warming up our planet. But as temperatures have risen, in part because of, you know, human activities and fossil fuels, temperatures have started to thaw the tundra. So microbes are kind of active, breaking down that stored plant matter. There are wildfires. And so, yeah, we're seeing that the kind of balance has flipped in the Arctic.
Is this report card all bad news, or is there maybe some good news here?
Definitely a lot of bad news, but there are some glimmers of good news, which I always love to look for. So ice seal populations around Alaska that have been challenged by rising temperatures, those populations look to be pretty healthy. There was also a pretty cool winter, which helped Greenland's ice sheet shed the smallest volume of ice in over a decade, which is exciting. But to be clear, you know, it's still melting. It's just melting slower than it has. So good news, but things are definitely serious.
Okay, we'll take it with a grain of salt. Let's shift gears here. We've been hearing a lot recently about bird flu, H5N1. And it's not just in birds, it's in cattle as well. But now there's news about a testing program for milk.
Yes. So this is the first mandatory testing program. The USDA announced it this week. So for about 9 months, we've seen the virus H5N1 spreading through dairy cows. And there have been some states that have started testing for this to really understand where dairy herds are being affected and to what extent. But now we'll have a mandatory testing program starting with just 6 states, but it should expand. And this should hopefully help researchers get a better handle on where this virus is spreading and how.
Do we know what's going to happen when a test comes up positive? At poultry farms, for example, we've heard that there's been a ton of culling of animals. Would that possibly happen here too?
Yeah, it's a really different situation because when birds are affected, it can be really deadly for them. Cows seem to very rarely die from infection, so I don't know that that's very likely. I think that really the main goal right now is just tracking and understanding. The virus it's possible that it's spreading to humans through cows. We don't really know if infected milk is able to infect humans. But it's possible that if the virus goes through mammals, it could become more dangerous for humans. So just getting a better understanding is, I think, really the key thing here.
Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye out on that news into the new year. But let's shift to some more positive animal news. There's been work towards protecting the monarch butterfly. Tell me about this.
Yes. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is adding monarch butterflies to the threatened species list by the end of next year. It's, you know, kind of bad news, but we've known for a long time that monarch butterflies, we've seen populations going down. And so this status would basically, like you said, help protect the butterfly. It would prohibit people from killing or transporting it. There would be kind of restrictions around what people can do with milkweed, which is an important food source for monarchs. And it would sort of protect some of their key habitat in California.
So would this actually like lock away habitat from development?
because this would list them as a threatened species and not an endangered species, it's not quite as strict. But yeah, those 4,000 acres in coastal California, there would be kind of restrictions and like certain rules around development. So it definitely would affect some people, but it's not quite as strict.
Mm-hmm. A lot of things are potentially going to change with this new political climate that we're entering into. Is this something that might be affected by a new administration?
Yeah, so this announcement opens up a public comment period of about 90 days. And so after that, the agency can kind of lock this in or tweak it or cancel it. So it's not a done deal just yet. And we'll have to watch. The agency has until the end of next year, if they decide to do it, to actually make this final.
Okay. So finally, our last story, we're going to move from butterflies to moths and a story about how they can actually listen to plants, Casey.
Yes. I wish I were a moth because I would love to be able to listen to what my houseplants say to me, like what I'm doing wrong.
I'm thirsty.
Literally. So yes, researchers have known for a while that some plants, when they're under stress, they make noises. They make ultrasonic clicks. So these aren't something that humans can hear, but some animals can, including some insects. And now researchers found that some moths are able to hear those sounds and interpret them as clues to decide where to lay their eggs. So basically, the researchers put two healthy plants on kind of either end of a room. Both were thriving. Both were hydrated. But they played the sounds of a dehydrated, you know, not very happy plant from one of those. And the moths avoided that one. Even though it was totally fine, it sounded like it wasn't. And so they really tended to prefer the healthy plant that wasn't making any distress noises. The idea here is that, you know, the healthy plant will be able to nourish their eggs. It'll provide a good food source. So they're really going for the healthy plants here. They want the best home that they can possibly get. So that's what researchers think is happening with this. Their listening skills.
Thank you so much, Casey. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to be here.
Casey Crownhart, climate and technology reporter at MIT Technology Review. After the break, a history of climate change, how the expansion of empires transformed our planet. Stick around. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. A new book called The Burning Earth, A History, takes on a massive question. How did we get here? Here being this point in environmental history and decades deep into human-fueled climate change. Over the span of 800 years of history, this book connects the dots on how the pursuit of empire, environmental destruction, and human migration led us here. Joining me is the author of The Burning Earth, Dr. Sunil Amrith, historian at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to Science Friday. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Sunil, how did the idea for this massive book come about?
So some of the themes in The Burning Earth I've been writing about teaching for two decades, though that was primarily focused on one part of the world, and that's India and Southeast Asia, which is where I do most of my primary research. So some of these questions, some of these themes have really been with me for a long time. But the question of what made me want to take on the story at the truly epic scale, as I do in The Burning Earth, was a coming together of various things. One was my own children, who are 10 and under, starting to ask me questions about how we've ended up in a place where the environment around us is in such peril. And I found that I didn't really have a clear answer for them. And so I thought I'd go away and put my historian hat on and my citizen/parent hat on. And it's really the synthesis of those two things that produced The Burning Earth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's start at the beginning. So if you had asked me to pinpoint an origin for the climate crisis, I think I would give you an answer, something like the Industrial Revolution or something a little bit more recent. But you start us off with the Mongol Empire in the 13th century. Why is this the start of the climate crisis, in your opinion?
I think it's the start of a heightened level of environmental transformation. I don't think it becomes the climate crisis until late. But the broader question of when is it that human societies or some human societies acquired the capability to transform not only their local environments, which human beings have always done, but to amplify and accelerate and spread those environmental transformations. In this case, in the case of the Mongol Empire, across most of the Eurasian continent, I thought that would be a moment of not origin, but of acceleration. The way that the Mongol Empire served as this catalyst for environmental transformation actually had to do with the fact that the Mongol Empire was very ecologically aware, if I can use that term, which is to say that its power and its profit actually came from throwing different ecologies together. It was the ability to trade, for example, in goods that were unique to distinctive parts of the world, to distinctive soils and ecologies. So much that we associate with modern globalization, and the seeds of that are there in this earlier moment of empire.
So as your book progresses and you go through all these different parts of human history, your book keeps going back to this theme that the climate crisis stems from the idea of setting ourselves free from nature. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, even today, that is not an idea that would make much sense to most people in the world, because it's a luxury that most people in the world do not have, to be able to ignore natural limits to what we can be and what we can do. But I do see the beginnings of that idea held initially by those who held wealth and power in the world, a sense that the limits to human life are starting to be transcended. And some of that is demographic. So there's a massive expansion of life expectancy in Europe. If you take the beginning of the 19th century and you look at the end of the 19th century, people are living longer. Many of the most devastating infectious diseases are now understood and can be treated. And there is this sense that some of the enduring limits to human existence, including limits to the accumulation of wealth, are being shattered by technology. And I think with that comes a very powerful idea that shaped how we live in the 20th century. The idea that we are outside nature, the idea that technology can solve any problem, the idea that we can insulate ourselves. That idea is always a fiction. And we see that so clearly with the climate crisis. And yet that fiction shapes institutions, it shapes ideas, it shapes images and visions of the future.
You spend a solid part of the book writing about war, especially World Wars One and Two. Let's start with the first. Why was the First World War such a turning point in climate history?
The First World War, even if it was primarily fought in Europe, was a truly global war in terms of its search for resources. It's been described as the first industrial war, the first carbon-fueled war. And by resources, I mean everything from fertilizer to wheat to timber, and of course to petroleum. The First World War is the first war in which petroleum is absolutely crucial to military action. And that was a shift that happened during the war itself. At the beginning of the war, very few military planners would have thought that oil would be as decisive as it was. By the end of the war, you have Allied leaders saying, we've essentially floated to victory on a sea of oil, most of which was coming from the US and Mexico at that time.
And one of the literal elements at play in World War One is nitrogen. How did the demand for nitrogen shape the outcomes of that war?
So profoundly and in a multifaceted way, because of course the two key uses of nitrogen come together in the First World War. One is as fertilizer for food production, and the other is in the production of explosives. And it was a few years before the First World War that the so-called Haber-Bosch process to capture nitrogen first was devised and implemented. A lot of that chemical knowledge is also then, in a particularly dark way, being used to manufacture the chemical weapons that are used by both sides in subsequent battles during the First World War. And that there is also a sense that it's a war over food, and that ultimately one of the big explanations for why the Allied side prevails in the First World War, and in fact the same could be said of the Second, we'll come to that, is the access that the Allies have to American, Canadian, and Australian grain.
Let's talk about World War II. I was really surprised to learn how famine in Europe created this cascade of events that eventually starved people quite far from there, places like Bengal and Indonesia. How did that happen?
The colossal impact of famine in Asia during the Second World War is really one of the less discussed aspects of that conflict. And we're talking about famines that took the lives of millions of people, particularly in India and Bengal, in Vietnam, in China, and as well as in Indonesia. And it was really the distorting effects of the war economy that brought these disasters about. There certainly were natural triggers, so to speak. In Bengal, it was a cyclone. In Java, it was drought, as it was in parts of China. But I don't think one can say that the famines were a direct result of those natural events. It was the breakdown of systems of distribution and supply. It was the deliberate policy of the ruling powers, both the British in India and the Japanese in Vietnam and Java, to divert food supplies to theaters of war, for example, to not provide relief, even when the warning signs were there that starvation was imminent. But it was also the disruptive effect the war had on everyday social and economic relations, and the fact that those without land, for example, suffered particularly. I mean, it's not an accident that it was the Bengal famine that was a key case study for the great economist Amartya Sen's work on famine in the 1980s, which argued that famine is not necessarily about an absolute shortage of food. It's about the decline in certain social groups' ability to access food. And I think that's very much what you see across Asia at the time.
So bringing us to a more modern time, you throughout the book describe this sort of violence as twinning. Violence against people is violence against the earth. Where there's genocide, there's ecocide. And we are seeing this play out in places like Ukraine, Lebanon, the Congo, Sudan, of course, in Gaza. How does this idea of twinning help us make sense of this point in time where it just seems like there is so much violence?
I think in some ways, one of the truly appalling and tragic features of the of what we're living through in terms of mass violence in the world today is that it's almost as if we'd forgotten war. When we talked about the obstacles to climate progress, for example, a lot of that had to do with the stance that different powerful nations would take about cutting emissions. It had to do with perhaps vested interests in the fossil fuel industry. And in some sense, the fundamental obstacle to any kind of environmental progress, war had never gone anywhere and had never gone away. And it has reasserted itself with a vengeance. At the simplest level, reminding ourselves that warfare has always been a driver of both human suffering and environmental harm is something we need to just keep very firmly in our minds when we think about all of these contemporary wars. I think it can be difficult to focus on the environmental consequence of war because it can feel like that is somehow turning our attention away from the appalling human suffering that we're seeing all around us. And in fact, I think it does the opposite. I think if we take into account the environmental consequences of our current wars in Gaza, in Ukraine, and so many other parts of the world, what we realize is that the environmental injuries only prolong the human suffering. There are many estimates that scientists on the ground have made that the damage of these wars is going to be intergenerational. So even when finally peace comes, the task of environmental repair will be a forbidding and a very, very long-term one. So I think that's what twinning does. It reminds us that human suffering and environmental harm very often accelerate together.
And it almost sounds like you're saying peace has to be part of climate progress. Is that right?
That's a beautiful way of putting it, Kathleen. I would wholeheartedly sign up for that as a key message in The Burning Earth. I think in some ways, war and peace have been issues that have not come up so very much in COP gatherings and even in just the way in which the climate debate is framed. But without peace, the first year of the conflict in Ukraine generated more emissions than Bangladesh produces in a year. Bangladesh, a country of more than 100 million people, which Wow. is more climate vulnerable than most. So what does it mean to talk about environmental justice if we're not grappling with the fact that at the very same time, military action is itself a colossal driver of environmental injustice?
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. If you're just joining, I'm talking with historian Dr. Sunil Amrith about how we got to this point in the climate crisis. Throughout your book, you come back to the similar themes of greed, power, and money over and over again. Do you think that the future of our planet will be different?
I think the future of our planet could be different. And I think one of the things that I was very determined to do in The Burning Earth is to reckon with what is a very dark and difficult history of greed and destruction and domination, but at the same time to remind us that that history has never been linear and it's never been unchallenged, and that there have been voices that have provided an alternative vision of how we might live more peacefully and less violently on this earth. They're up against a formidable challenge, but the very fact that the environmental movement has grown from almost nothing in the 1970s to what is probably the single cause that mobilizes more people, especially young people, than any other, is for me at least a source of hope that we could write a different story. We're in the middle of this history. I suppose that's the thing about The Burning Earth. This is not about a closed chapter. This is a book that provides a historical account of a story that we are still writing, that we're still right in the midst of. And that, to me, is a source of hope.
So how do we take what we learn in this book and actually funnel it into climate action? Is there a concrete action that you would like to see the world take?
I think there are two parts of how I'd answer that. The first is one of the key themes in The Burning Earth is that one thing that has changed very little, whether we're talking about the Mongol Empire or we're talking about today, is that it remains the case that how and what we eat and produce food is a fundamental driver of our impact on the planet, including on the climate crisis. Agriculture accounts for about a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions. I was stunned of all the things I found when I was doing the research for The Burning Earth. I think the single statistic that has stayed with me is the idea that if the carbon emissions from food waste were a country, they'd be the third largest emitter in the world after the US and China.
Wow.
So that's one level, I think. And another is, I think, that taking a historical perspective reminds us that we need joined up thinking. We need to think about the climate crisis and the crisis of biodiversity and the crisis of human inequality, really all as part of the same story. I think we miss things when we start to isolate any one of these problems from the others.
How can people take the lessons from this book and incorporate them into their day-to-day lives?
I think one of the things I have concluded at the end of the process of researching and writing The Burning Earth is that our actions matter, and I think we need a better reason for rationalizing why they matter. I think it's very easy to say, well, my recycling more is not going to make a dent in any of the environmental challenges we face. And that might even be true, but I think our actions matter intrinsically. Our actions towards environmental protection matter, first of all, because they make us who we are. They reflect the values that we have about the way we want to live in the world. Second of all, because they bring about a shift in collective consciousness. The more people we have in our communities, in our schools, on our campuses, in our cities, in our countrysides who are thinking about a more sustainable future, the more that becomes part of the currency, that becomes part of the ways in which we imagine and craft more hopeful futures. We should be thinking in grand, maybe even cosmic ways, about shifting towards a more ecological consciousness. And in that sense, I think everything matters.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that your kids were an inspiration for this book. You wanted to answer their question of how we got here. What do they make of your answer? Have they read the book? Have you told them about what you found?
My daughter, who's 7, was particularly excited that I mentioned Blackpink at the end of the book because there are ways in which actually the mobilization of musicians and artists and video game designers and filmmakers are moving us forward. They're moving us towards a different way of imagining our place in the world. And a whole group of Blackpink fans got together to create a group, which I found very inspiring, called K-Pop for Planet. And my kids are very taken with that level of action where the enthusiasms of young people come together with causes that matter to all of us.
Well, what a lovely place to end off. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Kathleen.
Dr. Sunil Amrith is the author of The Burning Earth, A History. To read an excerpt from the book, head to sciencefriday.com/burning. And for all the book lovers out there, next month, the Sci-Fry Book Club is reading John Valiant's Fire Weather on the Front Lines of a Burning World. It explores our relationship with fire through time and the role of the oil industry. Join our online community of book lovers and enter to win a free book at sciencefriday.com/bookclub. After the break, the history of PFAS, aka forever chemicals, and their origins in New Jersey. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. And now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
KQED Iowa News. Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. We've talked a lot on this program about the problem of PFAS chemicals, the so-called forever chemicals that are just about in everything in our environment. And we often say something like, used in nonstick coatings, flame retardants, and stain repellents. But all that traces its history back to the accidental invention of one substance, Teflon. Joining me now is Jordan Goss-Perret, creator and host of the Hazard NJ podcast. The new season looks at the history of PFAS and their role in New Jersey. Jordan, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen. I appreciate it.
So remind us again of what PFAS chemicals actually are.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say PFAS because I usually pronounce it PFAS, but then when I was recording episode one, I said PFAS, so I've had to keep it that way throughout the entire season. They're a class of thousands of chemicals. So it's not just one, two, three, four, five. There are thousands. And the big kicker about these chemicals, though, is that the ones that we at least know about and the ones that we have research and that we've studied have been linked to numerous health risks. Again, PFAS, there's thousands of these chemicals. It's not just one.
So this traces back to Teflon, which was not an intentional invention. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think this story was the most fascinating to me because I saw this season as the beginning of PFAS and the end, hopefully, of PFAS in New Jersey. It started in New Jersey, and our last episode really gets into what's being done to get rid of PFAS once and for all in New Jersey. And so I actually had no idea that Teflon was discovered in New Jersey until working on this project. 1938, you know, setting the stage here that, you know, in a lab in deep South Jersey, it was Roy Plunkett. He was 27. He was a, you know, pretty low-income kid, grew up in Ohio, and he started working for DuPont. It was a really good paying job, moved to South Jersey. And what he was supposed to be doing at the time of this accidental discovery of Teflon was trying to figure out a DuPont version of Freon. So it was him and his assistant, Jack Rebick. So they're trying to work on finding a DuPont version of Freon, and they're experimenting with this new gas. And they think, you know, maybe we'll figure something out here. Things aren't going according to plan. And then one day they open up this canister and they discover this white powder. And that was the beginning of Teflon. They started testing this powder and they realized that it wouldn't break down. Didn't break down when it was exposed to heat, electricity, most solvents. And yeah, that turned out to be PTFE, which DuPont later dubbed Teflon.
Okay, so let's hear this clip from Roy Plunkett.
I'm proud of my part in this development. I'm proud of the company with whom I worked. I'm proud of what has happened. And most of all, I'm proud of all the benefit to mankind from this original invention. The discovery of PTFE has been variously described as an example of serendipity, a lucky accident, a flash of genius. Perhaps all three were involved.
So it turns out, though, that this didn't really catch on at first in the industry until the Manhattan Project. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the interesting thing about this was DuPont is also connected to nylon. So, you know, nylon, we most often think of it as in nylon hosiery. So your pantyhose made out of nylon. And this was, you know, right around the kickoff of World War II when nylon was invented. And that, unlike PFAS, was a very purposeful discovery. They were looking for stronger fibers. And so they were all concerned about that. And, you know, then comes World War II. And you have this General Groves. He was the director of the Manhattan Project. And he had heard through the grapevine about Teflon and how great this new chemical was. And like I had mentioned before, how, you know, it's really difficult to break down. And so General Groves goes to DuPont and says, you're going to have to ramp up development. And pretty much from what I've read, in a nice way of threatening DuPont, saying, if you're not going to ramp up development, the military is going to take this chemical away from you. So DuPont said, okay, great. We'll be able to supply you with enough of this product for all the things that you're doing, the secret things you're doing with the Manhattan Project.
Wow. Okay. So after the war, this material found its way into consumer products. And I think the one that most people are going to be familiar with is the Teflon pan, right?
Yes. So DuPont released the first Teflon coated pots and pans in 1960. They released it at Macy's in New York City, and they were correct. They kept thinking this was going to be a hit. Sure enough, it was a hit. And I found the price of that original Teflon pan that you were wanting to buy at Macy's in 1960. And it was $6.94,
Whoa.
In case anybody was curious about that.
That's fascinating. Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit. It turns out that related materials weren't just useful in your frying pan. They found other uses, right? Like in firefighting foam.
They did. Yeah. So, that first PFAS chemical for Teflon was really resistant to heat and was really hard to break down. And also with the Manhattan Project and the U.S. military getting interested in this and using it. We talked about a little bit the Forrestal disaster. It was a big fire on a Navy ship. And this really hit the U.S. Navy very hard. And they kept thinking, like, what could actually have been done to have prevented this disaster? And that's what was really leading people into the research of, we need a better firefighting foam. And the PFAS chemicals fit the bill. That was one product. But I mean, PFAS has become so highly ubiquitous that, I mean, even today when I put on my waterproof jacket to go outside, I was thinking there's probably PFAS in that. My mom, when I was a kid, I remember Scotch guarding my shoes, spraying that stuff in the house in front of me. Scotch guard has PFAS in it. They're in all sorts of everyday products. Like they're in fast food wrappers, they're in face masks, they're in toilet paper. It's everywhere.
So, I mean, with things like firefighting foam where you are spraying them everywhere and, you know, when you're washing your Teflon pans, I mean, is that stuff just all getting into the environment?
It is. And I think one of the interesting things about this is that, you know, even thinking about, well, I have these products already, like a Teflon pan, I don't want to use them anymore. I'm going to throw them in the trash and I'm going to buy pans that don't have any PFAS or products that don't have any PFAS in it because I did my research. Okay, you're throwing it in the trash. Where do those products end up in the trash? They're going to go to a landfill. They can't be recycled. And in that landfill, PFAS will leach out of those products and be able to then go into drinking water systems, go into rivers and aquifers that supply your drinking water. And you have what some of the scientists I've spoke with call this PFAS cycle, which is terrifying.
Jordan, I have done that exact thing with my nonstick pan that I got a little too scared of. Okay, so you have it in the water and in all these products. Is it in us?
It is in nearly all of us. And I say nearly all of us instead of completely all of us, because I imagine that most of us have not had our blood tested for PFAS. I remember one scientist saying too, and this really terrified me, is that PFAS has been found in polar bears. It's everywhere. You can't escape it.
And we have a clip here from Graham Peasley, who's Professor Emeritus at the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Notre Dame.
Gee, we're finding PFAS in every blood sample in every blood bank. In fact, you have to go back to the Korean War to find blood that didn't have it. There's no blood left in North America that doesn't have PFAS in it, from cord blood to adult blood, anywhere.
So, I mean, you looked specifically at the town of Paulsboro, where researchers from Rutgers have been studying blood samples from residents. What have these researchers found?
Yeah, so the whole purpose of the study was to try to see, is there a link between PFAS and different health conditions? So, that study has not officially concluded.
So we'll wait to see the result of that blood study from Rutgers. But I mean, this is such an overwhelming issue, it feels like. Is there any hope or signs of progress towards cleaning up this problem?
One hopeful thing is that earlier this year, for the first time ever, the EPA announced new drinking water standards for 5 PFAS chemicals in drinking water, which was huge. What I've been told, because there is some hesitation, the fear that some of these things might be rolled back and it might be left up to the states to to figure out the PFAS contamination sort of on their own. Hopefully they won't be rolled back. New Jersey was sort of at the forefront in 2018 of setting their own standards. And that, you know, I don't think it would be a bad idea if other states also decided to set their own standards and follow suit, especially more stringent standards. I don't want to get doom and gloomy, but I think the EPA announcing that those drinking water standards for the five chemicals is a good step in the right direction. But it looks like it's going to be chemical by chemical. So again, you know, PFAS, there's thousands of PFAS chemicals, and the EPA mm-hmm. is only regulating now five. Hopefully, maybe we might follow suit like in Europe, where they're considering drinking water standards for the entire PFAS family and other like families of chemicals, instead of doing it chemical by chemical.
Jordan Gosperé, creator and host of the Hazard NJ podcast, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
People are finding all sorts of uses for mushrooms these days. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to focus on two of them: how scientists are using them in robots and how playwrights are using them in theater. A few weeks ago, sci-fi producer and host of our podcast, Universe of Art, Dee Peter Schmidt, checked out the Science in Theater Festival in Brooklyn, New York. It's put on by a company called Transforma Theater, who staged science-inspired plays. And one of those playwrights was inspired by mushroom research that seems stranger than fiction. Here's Dee.
When director and playwright Hannah Sims was commissioned to write a play for the Science in Theater Festival earlier this year, she didn't have to look too far for inspiration.
Well, I had just had a baby, and that was the most profoundly science fiction experience of my life. And pregnancy was my experience of having this really intimate connection with a being growing inside my body, so closer than I've ever been to anyone, but we had no form of communication beyond this sort of woo-woo cellular feeling about our connection.
Hannah was directed to a growing field of research called unconventional computing, where scientists are trying to figure out how to connect various parts of nature, like mushrooms, to computers. Mushrooms have these root-like threads called mycelium, which turns out generate electrical signals. It's a small amount, but it's enough to send through wires to control a basic computer interface. Different species of mycelium produce different types of electrical signals depending on what they're exposed to, like a chemical or light. But some scientists suggest that this signaling could be a form of communication for these fungi, and maybe even a sign of consciousness. Hannah's play, Fruiting Bodies, takes those ideas a few steps forward.
One of the sort of foundational concepts of my piece is that the character creates a fetal monitor that runs on mycelium.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. That character, Yara, who studies fungal computing, is in the final months of her pregnancy and creates a mushroom-powered fetal heart monitor almost as a side project. But then, with some artistic license from Hannah, she discovers she can talk with the mycelium powering the heart monitor, who has a different kind of connection with her unborn child than she does. And both their worlds open up in surprising and complicated ways. Endogeny, the name of the mycelium colony, is played by a human actor. Here's a snippet from the play between Yara and Endogeny, played by Chloe Mutabi and Eureka Nakano-Grimes. Endogeny speaks first.
You want me to learn me your yes-no language?
Yeah, but code is not a language. Like, no one is born speaking it.
Not your machines?
Machines, they're built to speak it.
Built and born are different.
Yeah. Humans build things with our hands and born things, birth people from our abdomens. Can I show you?
Yara puts Endogeny's hand on her belly.
In there, there's a new one.
Ah, oh, yes. A part of you that will reach farther out? A foraging front?
Yeah, kind of exactly, actually. I guess it makes sense you know about that. Do you feel the
sonic pulses? Yes.
His heartbeat. We gotta go to the lab tomorrow.
A fetal heart monitor powered by mycelium that can talk to you and sense your unborn child. That's not something you can pick up at CVS yet.
It's not a thing you would do, but I needed it.
But this idea of translating mycelium's electrical signals to a device or a machine is catching on with other scientists like Anand Mishra. He's a research associate at Cornell University in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, and he specializes in what's called soft robotics. He's made robots that grow like plants, robots that have skin, and even robots that sweat to cool themselves down.
If you wanted to imagine what the future robotics should look like, you need to have some integration of biology.
And earlier this year, Anand published research about a new kind of robot he helped make, and it's entirely powered by mycelium. One of them looks like a starfish with five robotic legs. A petri dish filled with king oyster mycelium sits on top, connected to the robot by wires.
We grew mycelium in a petri dish. We put up electrodes on that, and we design a new kind of real-time control system, which is like reading the mycelium signal in real time and then sending it to a robot.
Mycelium produced these rhythmic electrical spikes that sent through electrodes to a control interface, which interprets those spikes and sends signals to the pneumatic motors in the legs of the robot, which kind of scrunches them up and then releases them. And that scoots the robot across a flat surface. King oyster mycelium are also sensitive to ultraviolet light. And when the team flashed that light onto the mycelium petri dish, it changed the gait of the robot.
So imagine like hidden signal has now a mechanical visualization. So I feel like that's why it's so exciting to use this living system as a living material and develop such a system that can do more job.
Because mycelium acts as a natural sensor, researchers are thinking that they could use fungal robots to monitor the health of ecosystems, like soil health or air quality. And since fungi are a renewable and biodegradable resource, it offers a more sustainable way to build and power robots.
I think one of the other reasons that fungi have really captured consciousness right now is that they are so adaptable and can grow in the harshest of conditions. And considering what we have been doing to our planet, that's something that humans are really interested in, is how do we adapt? How do we continue to thrive in harsh environments? So I think what Anand is talking about is really exciting from that perspective.
Mycelium are also known for their ability to form complex networks underground that transport nutrients and send signals to nearby plant life, which was a pretty irresistible concept for Hannah.
I think that's why I was so drawn to it. Fungi as a metaphor for connection in a time that feels so disconnected. And fungi as a metaphor for listening. I think a lot of people right now go around knee-jerk reacting to things and as a result, dehumanizing and murdering each other. As we go around doing that, fungi seem like a really appealing symbol of what real connection and real synthesis could look like.
If you're in the New York area and want to catch more science-inspired plays like this in the future, check out Transforma Theater, who put on the Science and Theater Festival. I'm Dee Peter Schmidt.
Thanks, Dee. And that's all the time that we have for this hour. Lots of folks helped make the show happen this week, including
Emma Gomez,
Annie Nero,
George Harper,
Phyllis Mayers.
Thanks, everybody. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of the program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. You can email us too. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. I'm Kathleen Davis. Thanks for listening. This is Science Friday. I'm SciFry producer Kathleen Davis. Later in the hour, is too much sitting bad for you? Plus, how blind women are being trained to detect breast cancer. But first, it feels like there's been an onslaught of food recalls this year. We've seen recalls for items like cucumbers and carrots, deli meat and smoked salmon, foods that have been contaminated with salmonella, E. coli, listeria, and more. As a consumer, it can be stressful and even scary to keep up with food recalls. So today, we're going to break down how a food recall happens, if there are actually more recalls this year than in other years, and some food safety tips. Joining me to help us break this down is my guest, Dr. Byron Chavez, food scientist and associate professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So first off, is there actually a giant wave of food recalls this year?
You know, that's a great question that we've been getting pretty frequently these days. And I would say no. I would argue that if we look at the data, that we haven't really seen a spike in food recalls compared to previous years, if we statistically compare the data. I think that recently what's been happening is that the recalls that we've had have been very heavily publicized. And so it feels like there's a lot more of those recalls happening.
So walk me through how a food recall happens. You know, what is the first step?
Yeah, totally. So typically, either the company that produces the food or a state or federal agency discovers that there's something wrong, right? It could be that the product is directly contaminated, or there is suspicion that the product might be contaminated. And so at that point, companies will work directly with state and federal agencies to determine what is the level or the class of recall that has to happen, and that is based on the risk associated with the potential hazard. And then those federal and state agencies will do some advertising. And that is when we see things in the news, we hear things on the radio, it goes on social media, just to warn the consumers that that product should not be consumed. But it typically starts with testing something or reviewing records and identifying that something may have gone wrong.
And so when we're actually talking about contaminations, are we talking about a contamination on the surface of the food or grown into the food or both?
It could be any. It could be that, you know, some contamination is typically external. So if we think about whole fruits and vegetables, so we typically see external contamination. But if we had something like fresh cut fruit, then of course that contamination is already in the flesh. And so it's a little different. Think about meat products that have been tenderized versus meat that has not been tenderized, right? So in the tenderized version, we might have pathogens inside of the tissue, but in the intact version, the pathogens would only be on the surface. So it could be a number of different things.
Okay, so let's get into how these recalls actually work. So let's say that I eat a carrot that's coated in E. coli here in New York, and then someone else does the same in Alaska, and we both get sick. How do federal agencies connect those illnesses back to a common product?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's where the epidemiological system really comes in. So the first thing that would have to happen really is that the two people that got sick actually get sick enough that they seek medical attention. And that is one of the reasons why so many of these instances of foodborne illness are never captured, because we might get sick, but not severely enough that we have to go to the doctor. And so if two people go to the doctor because of a foodborne illness and they get tested and that microbe is identified, then that goes into a national database. And then we can start seeing clusters of people that get sick. And that is where federal agencies like the CDC will come in and try to put two and two together. And we start asking people, what did you eat? And that is how federal agencies will put those two cases together and then potentially declare an outbreak. But it really starts with seeking medical attention.
So one thing I was surprised to learn was that about half of the cases of foodborne illness comes from tainted produce. I would have thought that the majority would be from things like meat and eggs. So why is produce so germy?
Yeah, great point, right? And so we do see that the ecology of foodborne pathogens changes over time, right? And so we used to have a lot of issues with foods of animal origin. So you mentioned meat and poultry and eggs. And a lot of those problems have switched to minimally processed foods. And so we typically want things like fresh produce. We want to have fruits that are maybe exotic, and we want to have them year-round. And so that has put a lot of pressure in intensifying agricultural systems. And so that also has put a lot of pressure into importing food commodities, right? Because we want to have them all year-round. Produce has become one of these things where we see a lot of issues because they do come from naturally contaminated environments. Obviously, we do a lot of things to prevent direct contamination of that food product on the farm and stuff like that, with irrigation water, with biological soil amendments of animal origin. All of those things we really try. But let's keep in mind that a lot of these foods come from natural environments that are open to wildlife, to different sources of water, and that they can become contaminated fairly easily.
What are the most common food contaminants, and how can they affect the body?
Yeah, we hear about those all the time. Things like Salmonella, E. coli, Listeria monocytogenes. So these are big names of microbes, right? And so something that I really want to point out is that when we think about E. coli, there's lots of different types of E. coli, and most of them actually will never cause illness, right? So we have E. coli in our gastrointestinal tracts. So a lot of those types of E. coli are the good ones. But we have a group of E. coli that are highly pathogenic. And so that is when we see things like Shiga toxin producing E. coli that are really scary names. So think about Salmonella, pathogenic E. coli, and Listeria monocytogenes as the big ones. They can cause anything from diarrhea and fever and sometimes vomiting to some very serious illnesses. So pathogenic E. coli, the one that we saw in the onion outbreak associated with McDonald's,
mm-hmm.
right? So that one, it's particularly dangerous. That one can cause bloody diarrhea, kidney failure, can make you go on dialysis the rest of your life. You could potentially need a kidney transplant, right? So those microbes are extremely serious. There are others that are really serious only for specific groups of population, such as Listeria monocytogenes is particularly problematic for pregnant women, for immunocompromised individuals. But for a healthy adult, it might just be fever or feeling a little unwell. Same with Salmonella. If we get Salmonella, we'll have probably a couple of days that you're going to have diarrhea, potentially vomiting, fever, but it's going to be self-limiting. And so let's keep in mind that while all of these microbes can be pathogenic, meaning that they can cause illness, that the severity will largely depend on the immunological status of the host. And so that is when we make differentiations between a healthy adult versus somebody that's immunocompromised versus children and the elderly, as well as pregnant women.
And I would assume that these recalls can be really expensive for companies. So I'm assuming that they're pretty careful about contamination.
Yes. Something that we really need to keep in mind is that companies don't want this to happen, right? Companies mm-hmm. don't want to be associated with that really bad PR. They don't want to have to spend money recalling products. And so they do go through programs where they do mock recalls, right? So they can determine internally what is the percentage of their product that it's currently in the market that they can recover if they had to recall a food product. And so they go through these exercises. They work very closely with federal agencies, with state agencies. And like you mentioned, recalls can be very expensive. It is estimated that it can be, depending on the depth of the recall, anywhere from $100,000 to $10 million, right? So if you have products that are everywhere in the country, maybe placed in markets abroad, you still have to take care of those. And so the liability is really high.
Mm-hmm. How good would you say the USDA and the FDA are at catching contaminated foods?
They're very good. I would argue that they are very, very good, right? That doesn't mean that there's still a lot of opportunities for improvement. But both of those federal agencies that you mentioned are the two main food safety agencies, really, in the country, right? So we think about USDA for meat, poultry, and processed eggs, as well as catfish, and then for the FDA for pretty much everything else. And so they have certain capacities, and also they have certain limitations. In the case of the FDA, for example, we have relatively new regulation that allows the FDA to mandate a recall. So they can tell a company, you must remove this product from the market. Whereas the USDA does not have congressional authority to do that. And so they can only pass voluntary recalls. Of course, they have other mechanisms that they can apply so that companies remove products from the market. But in that case, all of the recalls end up being voluntary. It is in the best interest of the company to voluntarily recall a product because you don't want consumers to get sick with your product.
So from what I can understand, these recalls can sound scary, but they're also a sign that the food safety system is working, right?
Yeah. You know, this is debatable, right? A lot of people, if you ask somebody else, maybe they would give you a different answer. But I would really lean towards, yes, we see these recalls and we know that the system is working because we are able to catch contamination. Of course, we catch contamination all throughout the food supply from primary production, whether that's for animals or produce, and then through transformation and processing and manufacturing and distribution. As well as at the endpoint, right, for retailers. There's contamination that it's been discovered all throughout, and that is a sign that the system works because that product never actually makes it to the pantries of the consumers. But there is certainly a proportion of product that will always be contaminated and that poses a risk because we live in a statistical world, right? Like we live in a system of probability. And catching contamination is a statistical process. We can only have a certain level of confidence that the food supply is safe. And while we have a very, very safe and robust food safety system, there's always opportunities for contamination.
So we are almost out of time here. But before we go, can you leave us with a few food safety tips? Maybe like three rules that I should follow?
Absolutely. You know, the ones that we give all the time, wash your hands. That's a typical one. You want to prevent cross-contamination. You want to make sure that foods that are hot should be hot. Foods that are cold should be cold. And in the case of Rickles, I really would say, read the labels, look at the news. I would say subscribe to federal agencies, social media platforms. So if you think of the FDA, the CDC, the USDA, they will keep you informed. So keep an eye open and an ear open for news of products that are being recalled so that you protect yourself and your family.
Byron, thanks so much for joining me. This was a great conversation.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Byron Chavez is a food scientist and associate professor at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. After the break, how much sitting is too much sitting? We'll talk about it. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. Odds are that you've heard over the past few years that there's a very common activity that's not very good for us, and that's sitting. Too much sitting has been linked to poor health outcomes, which can be scary for those of us who work at a desk most days. A recent study in the journal PLOS ONE sheds more light on just how much sitting is too much and the kind of health complications that are tied to that. Here with me to explain are two authors of that study, Dr. Chandra Reynolds, professor in the Institute of Behavioral Genetics at the University of Colorado in Boulder, also professor emerita at the University of California, Riverside, and Ryan Brolman, PhD candidate in genetics, genomics, and bioinformatics at the University of California, Riverside. Welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Yes, thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Okay, so Ryan, sitting has gotten a bad rap. There was this phrase that was going on a few years ago that sitting is the new smoking. What's your perspective on this?
Yeah, so there was a lot of information coming out about sitting and, you know, how bad is it? Is it, as you said, a lot of people wondered, is it the new smoking? But really, it's another behavior to really just focus in on. There are many different behaviors that we do that kind of form the puzzle pieces of our health. And I think sitting is one of those puzzle pieces. And just thinking about how much you're sitting is something to really consider and really focus in on really across your age range. It doesn't matter if you're older or younger, it does matter throughout your entire lifespan.
And why is sitting bad? Is it because of the specific position our body is in, or is it something else?
So there are a multitude of different reasons for different things that can cause this. One of which could be just sitting for a long period of time in one position is not really, our body's not really used to that. Some individuals might have felt this if they've been on a plane doing an international leg or across country. You get up and it's like, oh, you can feel it in your body. Your body's speaking to you and saying, hey, get up and move around at least a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So Chandra, your expertise is in aging. Is there a correlation between sitting and aging? I mean, why study these two things in tandem?
Yes. So I think sitting makes up a behavior that's related to sedentary behavior. And we do know from studies that it's more optimal to be engaging in physical activity compared to sedentary behavior. So there have been studies suggesting a link with less optimal health outcomes for individuals who are more sedentary and less active. And so we wanted to see what this might look like at younger ages as well. Part of our perspective in the projects that we're conducting is trying to understand how earlier life, including in early adulthood, how those might play out across the life course and impact how well we age.
Okay, so let's get into this specific study that you two did together. Chandra, explain to me what you were looking at and who you were looking at.
Yes. So in this project, we engaged participants from the Colorado Adoption Twin Study of Lifespan Behavioral Development and Cognitive Aging, which we call CATS Life. And we had followed up about 1,300 individuals in their late 20s to 40s who've participated in earlier long-term longitudinal studies, the Colorado Adoption Project and the Colorado Longitudinal Twin Study. And part of our objective was to look at environments and experiences, including things like sitting behavior and physical activity, and how these might relate to metabolic and other aspects of health. And part of our sample, as you can tell from the description, is that we include twins and siblings. And we wanted to enable us to rule out other factors that might be at play when we look at associations like the impact of sitting on health outcomes. And so studying twins, how they differ, enables us to rule out other things that might be at play, like genes or environments that individuals grew up in, and really focus on behaviors like sitting.
Can you kind of parse that out a little bit more for people who might not be familiar with how twin studies work? Why is it that you're able to glean maybe a different sort of information by using twins versus two people who are not related?
Certainly. So we did look at our entire sample too as well, but then we've focused in on the twins in particular. And I think the most salient example are that identical twins share all of their genes in common and their shared rearing environment. So we're controlling for some of those factors when we then look at differences among the identical twins and compare their similarities and differences in the behaviors of interest. So like how similar are they in sitting, but how different are they in physical activity, for example. So we can do some comparisons to see if there are impacts of things like sitting on health outcomes based on the comparison of the two twins, because this should, if it looks the same as when we look at all individuals, if it looks the same that the twin who's sitting more has less optimal health outcomes than their co-twin, then this gives us a lens that it might be a kind of exposure effect, a kind of environmental effect from that difference comparison.
So tell me what you discovered in terms of if the sitting really is having a profound effect on health and how much sitting seems to be too much sitting.
So so prolonged sitting we observed is bad for heart health. And we focused in on more sitting, particularly above about 8.5 hours a day, coupled with less physical activity was associated with worse cholesterol ratio. And so that was one indication. And then, and I'd love for maybe Ryan to follow up on this point, but our identical twin comparisons also showed this kind of pattern, but also some potential optimal effects of replacing sitting with vigorous exercise.
The kind of additional work that we were able to do with those identical twins, we looked at twins that differed in their behavior. So we had these identical twin pairs where one twin sat more than their respective co-twin, but maybe they got more physical activity. And we focused in on vigorous physical activity. So they got more vigorous physical activity compared to their co-twin. So them sitting more but getting more exercise, we called them the compensators. And then we had these twin pairs where the twin that sat less got more vigorous physical activity. So they're compared to their co-twin, they're replacing that sitting time with vigorous physical activity. What this analysis, this unique analysis that we could do, showed us was that replacing that sitting time is optimal. However, if you're not able to replace that sitting time, you can make up for higher levels of sitting time. It's just you're going to need to really amp up that vigorous physical activity, likely past what at least the current guidelines say.
Mm-hmm. So do we know if it is sitting as opposed to lack of physical activity? Like if I just lay down all day, is that the same as sitting?
Yeah, our study is not particularly set up to kind of parse apart the modes of sitting per se. As far as those finer details, that would definitely need to be a call for further research just to kind of look at those different modes and finer details.
Chandra, Ryan talked about this a little bit, but are the current guidelines for physical activity enough? Right now, I believe that's about 20 minutes a day of moderate exercise.
Sure. So the current guidelines are about 20 minutes moderate or 10 minutes vigorous per day. We think that based on this work and other work that these levels may not be enough for prolonged sitters. But sitting hasn't really sort of been in the forefront in terms of guidelines. And so we think this is another aspect by which, you know, when we consider what we do throughout the day, that we might be needing to consider that aspect as well in terms of our health, even at younger ages.
Mm-hmm. And just for people who might not be familiar with these guidelines, can you talk about what is moderate physical activity versus extensive physical activity?
There is kind of a scientific, like, heart rate kind of aspect to it, but really the best way to think about moderate versus vigorous physical activity would be you're doing some type of physical activity and pretend there's someone next to you. Could you have a conversation with them? Could you say more than a sentence to them? If you can, then it's likely going to be low or moderate level intensity activity. If you're going along and you can't say much more than a few words at a time to some individual that would be next to you, you're doing likely vigorous physical activity.
So for a lot of us, sitting is a very normal part of the day, right? I mean, I work at a desk all day. Some people have long commutes. If you're watching TV in the evenings, odds are you're watching TV while you're sitting. Chandra, can you remedy long weekdays of sitting with active weekends? Can you potentially cancel some of that out?
So we didn't directly look at that. Sort of the weekend warrior type, I guess. and that is something that could be studied. But I mean, certainly trying to get physical activity in your week as best you can is, you know, certainly something to aspire to. I don't know that it would fully erase the effects. And I think probably coupled with trying to move about the day more than one might otherwise do. So, you know, moving away from your desk, you know, taking walks around your space. And ideally, if you work in a space with others, go seek others out for conversations as makes sense, you know, trying to get some more movement during the day and then coupled with additional physical activity, ideally vigorously. And if that's the weekends, that's great.
So we've been talking a little bit about developing healthy habits and the importance of developing these habits early. But if someone is listening to this who is older and thinking, oh man, I need to adjust my habits and not sit so much. I know this is outside the scope of this particular study, Ryan, but could a later in life adjustment on habits still potentially have an impact on health?
I mean, absolutely. I think that while ours is more so focused on younger to more early to established adulthood, this can be translated across individuals as far as just thinking about their sitting behavior in particular. It's never too late to switch things around, so to speak, and really improve your healthy behaviors, whether that be anywhere from sitting less, doing more exercise, or any of the other major things that are known good things to do for one's health.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with my guests about how much sitting is too much sitting. My guests are Dr. Chandra Reynolds and Ryan Brohlman. I have to ask, what are your favorite strategies for breaking up a long day of sitting? I mean, Ryan, do you want to start?
Sure. I typically will get up and move around if I can. I do have a standing desk now. I do need to practice what I preach since I did write about this and I am studying this. But I've also found I do a lot of, you know, looking into different data sets and coding and things like that. And I've found that if I get into a proverbial block where I can't figure something out, stepping away and actually doing something, the best thing I've found is a run. Just going for a 15, 20, 30 minute run really does clear a lot of things, but just really walking away, going around and doing something and coming back it does help with your mindset, but thankfully too, it helps with your overall physical health.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Chandra?
Yes. So I do try to move more about the day, especially after the findings of this study. And I do take breaks and may go on a walk to find lunch, for example. And certainly after work, I also take walks with my dog or runs as well. So I do try to break up the day more. And it's also nice to have social interactions with others than being kind of really focused on Zoom after Zoom meeting. it's nice to get out.
Mm-hmm. So we have seen public health campaigns in the past for things like smoking to warn about the dangers of that. Should there be educational campaigns about the risks of sitting too much? What do you think, Ryan?
I think that this is a good conversation for individuals to start talking with their doctors or healthcare professionals. I know my doctor will ask me how much physical activity I'm getting, but I can't remember any time they've actually asked me how much do you sit in the average day. So I think it's important to start having those conversations with one's doctor, whether it be the doctor bring it up or you bring it up to the doctor, and just really start to get it in people's minds. How much am I sitting throughout the average day? Is it the majority of the day? Am I sitting the majority of the day at work? Am I sitting the majority of the day when I get home? And then even commuting as well to and from different places. So it's important to start at least thinking about it. And I think that could be a solid messaging, is just to get it in individuals' heads and to get into their minds of what their current level is at.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a lot about how there are still unanswered questions about a lot of the stuff that we would like to know. Chandra, what would you really love to study in the future now that we have this baseline?
Well, I do think that there's room for, evaluating other health outcomes than were examined here, and also doing some longitudinal follow-up as well. So for example, our next phase of the CATS Life study, we're looking at both individual self-report and Fitbit measures of both sedentary and physical activity behaviors and health outcomes as well. So I think trying to understand how we also sort of think about our physical activity and how we actually move about the day across a couple of weeks would be very interesting to consider.
That's all the time that we have for now. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Chandra Reynolds, professor in the Institute of Behavioral Genetics at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and also Professor Emerite at the University of California, Riverside, and Ryan Brohlman, PhD candidate in genetics, genomics, and bioinformatics at the University of California, Riverside. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And we want to hear from you. What are your favorite strategies for breaking up a day of sitting? Let us know by going to sciencefriday.com/sit. That's sciencefriday.com/SIT. We'll feature some of our favorite suggestions on our website in the coming weeks. After the break, how a group of blind women are being trained to detect breast cancer in India. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. Breast cancer is the second most common cancer worldwide, just behind lung cancer. And the earlier a breast tumor is found, the more likely it is that the person survives their diagnosis. An international program called Discovering Hands trains blind women to detect even the smallest lumps and bumps through breast exams and to hopefully catch cancer in an early stage. There's a cohort in India because there, only around one in every two people diagnosed with breast cancer survive. Sci-Fi producer Rasha Aridi is here with more.
Thanks, Kathleen. To learn more about the Discovering Hands program in India, I spoke with science journalist Kamala Thiagarajan, based in Madurai in southern India. She reported on this for NPR's global health blog, Goats and Soda. Kamala, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So, Kamala, what is Discovering Hands and where did it start?
The Discovering Hands program started in Germany, and it was founded by a German gynecologist, Dr. Frank Hoffman. And he just wanted to set up the program as a means of helping doctors out, and doctors who were having really crowded waiting rooms and didn't have time to do thorough breast examinations. So he wanted to train women to be able to do it for them, to someone to help them out. So that's how it started. The intention was to kind of catch breast cancer cases early.
Right. So why does this program train blind women specifically to detect breast cancers?
So Dr. Hoffman was wondering why he was seeing so many women come in with stage three breast cancer. And at a time when, you know, he couldn't really help them. And I think that weighed heavily on him. So when I spoke to him, he told me that doctors needed help because, you know, it was a failure of the healthcare system that they were catching women so late in the day when they couldn't really help them. And so what he wanted to do was train people to help these doctors catch these cases early. And when he was wondering whom he should train, he remembered like there were so many studies that said that blind people had a heightened sense of perception. And so he thought, well, you know, maybe I could use that heightened sense of perception and train these women to kind of catch breast cancer early. And so that's how the idea started.
Very cool. So basically, that there's some research that suggests blind people might be more in tune with their other senses like touch than sighted people because that's how they navigate the world. So the idea is to put that to use in medicine through giving breast exams?
Absolutely.
So how do the examiners conduct the breast exams?
They use skin-friendly braille tape and they tape it on the chest and then they divide the breast into zones. They use their fingertips and kind of probe and try to find, you know, if there are any small lumps that need to be brought to a doctor's attention. And so if they find something that needs more attention, then they flag that. So the examinations take about an average of 45 minutes. And this is the kind of time that doctors don't have today to give to their patients. But these women have been really, really successful in finding even the smallest of tumors.
Yeah. So how good are they at detecting lumps and bumps?
They have been surprisingly really good at detecting lumps that medical practitioners and patients themselves miss. They can find bumps 30% better than doctors, even before it shows up on imaging scans. So these are really, really tiny lumps. And it's thanks to their, you know, perception that they're able to detect it so early. And there were doctors who spoke to me for this project, and they said that, you know, once they're sure that the medical tactile examiners, as they're called, once they give it the all clear and the go ahead. And then they said, there's absolutely nothing more that we can do. We're very satisfied that they've been thoroughly checked.
So it seems like a win-win across the board then for doctors and patients.
Oh, yes, it's absolutely a win-win. And also for the women themselves, you know, visually impaired women in India struggle to find jobs. So this is one area where they can excel and it gives them a lot of dignity.
Yeah. On that note, you spoke with some of the women in this program. What did they share about their experiences? I mean, why do they choose to do this kind of work?
They said that they were very scared at the outset of being responsible for a woman's life this way or a woman's health. But then they finally found that, you know, with time and with the training, they were confident enough to do it. The very first thing that they had to learn was mobility training, because usually in India, you know, visually impaired women don't navigate things alone. There's always someone to help. So they said that the National Association of the Blind here that coordinates this program, it gave them mobility training first, and that was really helpful. So now they can walk to their hospitals where they're working with a cane, and that gives them a lot of independence. And then the fact that they're helping save lives, the practitioner that I spoke to said that, you know, it's giving them a lot of joy.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. I want to go back to some of the research that's been done. Do we know if the tactile examiner's work has led to better survival outcomes?
It has definitely led to better survival outcomes, but I think that a lot of the work in India still needs to be examined. It still needs to be, you know, recorded. The program is just starting out in hospitals in India, so we should, in the years to come, be able to have a clearer picture of how much it's helping. But at this point, we have about 75,000 deaths a year thanks to breast cancer in India. And a lot of this breast cancer is being caught in the later stages. So I think that just the very fact that they can catch tumors early will be saving lives.
Right. And on that note, in your reporting, you write that in India, only about 1 in 2 people survive breast cancer. Why is that rate so high?
Well, for one thing, we have a shortage of mammograms. And for another, like, you know, especially in our rural centers, if you want to go to a hospital that has a mammogram, it has to be a multi-specialty hospital. And that might involve considerable travel. And also the women involved, they are deeply conservative. You know, they may not agree or may not like or be comfortable with someone checking their breasts. And so in this way, the program has also helped because the women who are patients here who are being checked have shown greater, like, you know, trust in these medical tactile examiners. They feel less shame in being able to get checked up.
As you said, so this program, you know, isn't a substitute for having imaging equipment and trained physicians, but it's more so just another tool to help catch cancer early, right?
That's right. It's not a substitute. What I think it does is that it saves time for doctors and it ensures that women are caught at the earlier stages rather than when it's too late and when nobody can do anything about it, because that's just so heartbreaking. One of the reasons that doctors were seeing cancer at such a late stage was that, you know, women are self-reliant, right? So they check out their own breasts. That's what we've been asked to do. But then you can't often rely on that. So the fact that this program provides you with that support, someone who's trained in the anatomy of the breast, someone who would be able to identify it, who has a heightened sense of perception, I think in many ways that's a better deal. So yes, the idea would be, yes, we should have more equipment, but it's just practically not possible.
So, Kamla, what are you hoping that readers and our listeners take away from your reporting?
I'm hoping that readers take away the importance of preventative healthcare. You know, it's so important, not just to put out a fire, but to prevent it from happening in the first place. And, you know, I hope that they'll be more aware of their bodies, because that could save us a lot of grief and pain and time at the end of the day.
Kamla, thank you so much for your reporting and for talking to me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Kamla Thiagarajan is a science journalist based in Madurai, India, and I'm Sci-Fi producer Rasha Aridi. Back to you, Kathleen.
We're all familiar with Spider-Man, the red-suited hero who swings through New York. In the original comic book, our hero, the young Peter Parker, invents a device that lets him shoot webs of spider silk from his wrists. Now, more than 60 years after that fictional invention, scientists have made their own version of liquid silk that solidifies and can pick up objects. Joining me to talk about this is my guest, Dr. Marco Lopresti, biomedical engineer in the Tufts University Silk Lab, based in Medford, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, everyone.
So tell me a little bit about the Silk Lab that you work in.
There is a lot of things going on in Silk Lab. There are a lot of researchers studying on sensors, on solar cells, on hybrid biological microprocessor. And there's me, that I work mainly on adhesives. The name Silk Lab, of course, we are focusing the creation of most of the material we're creating here out of silk protein, silk fibroin protein, which is the protein extracted from a Bombyx mori cocoon. For my specific field, the adhesive, the protein is very appealing because it is well known for its stiffness. It's a very stiff protein with high mechanical properties. And also, on the chemical point of view, is like a detergent, acts like a soap, so it can wet easily any kind of material. And if you think about a material that is very strong and has nice wettability, is an amazing starting point for creating an adhesive. I created, together with all my colleagues here in Silk Lab, different formulation of adhesive, mimicking muscle, mimicking many different natural organisms, and why not, also mimicking some superheroes, inspired by some superhero. We created this formulation, which is indeed inspired by Spider-Man. It is the very first example of a solution, a liquid solution, that undergoing to transition, creating a fiber that can attach on a distant object, and so you can remotely capture a distant object with this material.
Help me imagine this. So I'm assuming you're not shooting this out of your hands like Spider-Man does, but how are you actually making this happen?
So this started with a bit of serendipity. This started while trying of developing underwater adhesive. Washing the vials with acetone, we noticing this transition into a web-like material. And again, inspired by pop culture, we started thinking about adding a bit of engineering on this chemistry and creating a material, just also to find it out if it was possible to create such kind of material, because so far the only application of this was done through CGI, but nothing physical. And so, with a lot of engineering, there is a lot of processing of the solution and a lot of chemistry to make this transition happen with the right timing to have the transition maintaining, of course, the fiber sticky. The transition from liquid to solid, it's something like when your super glue cures. When it cures, it's not adhesive anymore.
Just a quick note, this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. If you're just joining us, I'm talking about real-life Spider-Man science with my guest, Marco Lopresti. So what is the component that is making it have those unique properties? What is being combined with the silk?
The component to make this happen is a molecule which is very popular in the chemistry of underwater adhesive. The molecule is dopamine. It's very popular because the chemistry is mimicking the one of muscles. There is also something about muscles in this process. Even if the molecule is the same, the process is very, very different, because in muscles, dopamine polymerized into a polymer to ensure cross-linking into the material. In our case, dopamine is helping washing away the water from the silk fibroin solution and accelerating its transition into fiber. Similar to what the silkworm does for creating, for spinning the cocoon, but with the addition of some adhesive properties.
And is this the same dopamine that is, you know, going on in our brains and that makes us feel good?
Is the same dopamine, exactly the same neurotransmitter that we use to feel happy, indeed. And, you know, in a natural system, usually natural system use every time same chemistry or similar molecules. You will be surprised that this same molecule that you can find in muscle for creating underwater adhesive is also chemically the base for creating melanins, which add colors to our hair or our skin.
Wow, that is so fascinating. So tell me, how much weight can this silk solution actually hold once it's solidified?
So after improvement of how the silk transition into a fiber, we managed to reach 2 megapascal of tensile strength, where 2 megapascal means that a fiber with a diameter of 1 millimeter can potentially pull up to 160 grams. The maximum weight that we managed to lift was 5 grams up to a 15 centimeter of distance.
So give me a couple real world examples of items that you've actually been able to pick up.
So using a needle and creating a single fiber, we lifted some different objects. The weight was every time around between 5 grams and 10 grams. We tried different situations, different environments. We tried, for example, small plastic vials floating on the water. So even if a material has a wet surface, can be recovered. We tried some stainless steel nuts partially buried into a sand bath, and the solution can infiltrate, can percolate into the sand, creating a hole, and you can lift all the steel nuts with the sand. We tried also with a glass vial of 10 milliliter, a very smooth surface, and also that's very easy. I would say that the solution can lift heavier object when the material is absorbing and it's porous, because it allows the solution to be firstly absorbed, rooting into the material, and so increasing the surface area where it forms connection to mm-hmm. the material.
So this seems like a really fun thing to play with in the lab. But are there future applications that you see this for?
Are there future applications? So far, I would say the material is not ready for an application. Usually in the academic world, a publication also useful to share your findings with the other scientific community. And someone can think, hey, this technology might be very, very useful to solve this specific problem. We can address specific problem.
Thank you so much for your time. It was great speaking to you about all this.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Dr. Marco Lopresti, biomedical engineer in the Tufts University Silk Lab, based in Medford, Massachusetts. And if you want to see videos of this technology, you can do so on our website, sciencefriday.com/silkscience. And that's it for this hour. If you missed any part of the program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. And you can join us throughout the week via our newsletters, sciencefriday.com/newsletters. We'll see you next week. I'm Kathleen Davis.